Hello, and welcome to episode 6 of Is It Funny? I'm your host, Kate Leary, Dr. Kate Leary. I don't know why I'm branding it that way, but why not? So last time we were before the satire boom, and this episode 6 is about, mostly about not only but also, which becomes part of It grew out of the satire boom. Because one of the interesting things about the satire boom is that despite Beyond the Fringe really sort of starting it off, they kind of missed out on the monetizing of the satire boom. And part of the reason for that is that because they were a success in the West End, they went to the US, which to varying degrees was enjoyed by the cast members, some more than others. Peter Cook really enjoyed it. He enjoyed hanging out with the celebrities in the U.S. Apparently the Kennedys even came to the show, and there's rumors of something happening between him and Jackie Kennedy. Who knows what the truth is? But they were a big success in the U.S. And in fact, the LP that I first had was from their Broadway appearance, which had the additional sketch about coming to the U.S., which is makes the wonderful joke about American politics. And there's the Republican Party, which is roughly equivalent to our Tory Party, conservatives. And then there's the Democratic Party, which is roughly equivalent to the Conservative Party. Still true, unfortunately. Anyone who thinks there's real leftists in politics in the U.S. is wrong. So Beyond the Fringe moved to the U.S., and one of the things that happened was that was the week that was, which was started by David Frost, Frosty, who is known by most of the Cambridge set who were friends of Peter Cook as the bubonic plagiarist, because he was always willing to take somebody else's idea. And he was also very savvy about working with executives. So he had quite a successful career. And, you know, to his credit, Peter Cook never really took it seriously, although Alan Bennett always told the story of how the one regret Peter Cook had in life was saving David Frost from drowning. So, you know, that's by the way. And that's something that, I don't know, maybe I'll get to it eventually. So in the meantime, while they were still doing Beyond the Fringe in the West End, one of the things that Peter Cook had managed to do was achieve one of his sort of college life dreams, which was to start a satire club. And again, in his mind, this was very much linked to the history of the Berlin satire clubs of the, you know, the late Weimar Republic. And it was called the Establishment, which I think is just a genius idea, because everybody wanted to join the Establishment. You had to have a membership in order to come, and they sold far more memberships than they could ever possibly fit into this tiny club on Greek Street in Soho. But everybody was dying to be part of the Establishment. The other thing, the reason that it was a membership club was because, unlike play performances that went on in the West End and theaters, it did not have to go through the censorship process, which is one of the things that changed a few things in Beyond the Fringe, and to the horror of the censors. In some ways, they found workarounds that were much more objectionable if you knew what they meant. Teaching censors things is not part of the job. So the Establishment Club was very popular, and certainly Peter Cook's first wife talks about how the nights just went on and on and on, because they would be performing Beyond the Fringe on stage, and then they would all go to the Establishment Club, and they would just carry on. And some of it was performing. Dudley Moore would play piano for hours, and they would just get up on stage and have these long rambling sessions of comedy. And again, it was mostly Peter and Dudley. One of the other things that's connected to the Establishment Club was Private Eye. And Private Eye magazine was started by some other people, but very early on, Peter Cook came aboard as someone who injected a lot of money, which was very useful when they got sued, but largely kept a hands-off the editorial. In fact, when Private Eye went after friends of his like Jonathan Miller, He just threw his hands in the air and said, "I've got nothing to do with the editorial content," although behind the scenes he apparently had a good chuckle. And he did occasionally write for it. More on that later, because that's really not the point today. I'm just kind of wandering, I think, from the point that I wanted to make, the story that I wanted to talk about. So coming back after the successful run of Beyond the Fringe in the US, he was feeling a little bit sort of at loose ends. In the meantime, Dudley Moore, who had been appearing on various variety shows, playing music as well as, you know, sort of performing comedy, was asked by the Glaswegian producer, Joe McGrath, to star in and host a variety show of his own, you know, that would be part of the light entertainment section of the BBC. Peter Cook did also do a little bit of television. He started doing what had been the Arthur Grohl character and became officially E.O. Wistey on the Braden Beat. And this was incredibly successful, but it was just a small thing, you know, whenever he felt like it. But he would come on and do E.L. Wistey and have his plans for taking over the world. The World Domination League was one of the things that started on the Braden Beat. As he explained the World Domination League, "How we aim to go about it is as follows. We shall move about into people's rooms and say, 'Excuse me, we are the World Domination League. May we dominate you?' Then if they say, 'Get out,' of course, we give up." Which I think is just very typical and very E.L. Wistey. And I mean, it was popular enough that Watney's Beer actually hired him to do some advertisements, which you can find on, you know, YouTube. So meanwhile, McGrath and Dudley Moore were trying to plan a program which was going to be called Not Only But Also. And it was going to be not only Dudley Moore, but also various guests. And initially, it was very much aimed at the light entertainment model. So for the premiere episode, you know, the sort of pilot, Diane Carroll was going to be on singing some songs on her own and singing with the Dudley Moore Trio. The Dudley Moore Trio, of course, were going to be performing. And Norman Rossington, who is a comedy actor, I guess that's a way to put it, a comedy actor who appeared in some of the Carry On movies, and also probably more pertinent for my interest, he's also in Beatles' Hard Day's Night, which I guess I should talk about again more involved at some point. But anyway, but also, you know, sort of worrying about material and what to put on and sort of how to do really good comedy, he invited Peter to be part of it. And apparently the problem when you invite Peter to take part in things, it very quickly becomes Peter is kind of in charge. And before the first series was out, because eventually it did become a series, it was not only Peter Cook, but also Dudley Moore in many respects. The other sort of big get that they got for that pilot episode was John Lennon, who this is, let's see, 64. So really, but I mean, at the height of Beatles popularity, but still kind of near enough the beginning that it was something that was, you know, older people probably wouldn't have cared, but for younger people, this was going to get them on board. And he performed a couple of his poems and liked it so much that he came back again for further performance. He really enjoyed himself. A lot of the background of this you can get from Harry Thompson's biography of Peter Cook, and some of the background information, scripts, and etc. that you can find at the Peter Cook Appreciation Society, which I think their website is still up. I should check that. But this first episode was really important, different. It was strange enough that the new head, I think he was, the newly installed head of Light Entertainment, Tom Sloan, who's a little bit sort of legendary, saw the performance of the first pilot episode, and he said, "Well, if this is light entertainment, then I'm in the wrong business." And the BBC Two controller told him, "Yes, you're in the wrong business," which I think is just fantastic. Originally, it was thought maybe this would be just kind of a one-off, but as soon as the first trial episode came before the BBC controller, he said, "Give me six." So what happened was then a series of six shows. The process was very interesting and quite revolutionary for sort of how programs normally went, which was lots and lots of time spent on writing, a little bit of rehearsal, and then filming. And this, again, I'm going to be reading from Harry Thompson's biography here. And he says, the show was entirely created in the fortnight before transmission. There would be 5 days writing, 2 days filming, and the rest of the time would be given over to rehearsals. Another radical departure was that the sets were kept to a minimum, just a hint here and there of a saloon bar or a sitting room. It was another happy accident that helped focus the audience's attention on the strength of the material. Even though they only had to write 3 sketches a fortnight, Peter and Dudley reserved the right to deliver their material late or change their minds at the last minute. Frequently, the faintest suggestion of a pub was all the designer actually had time to build. A little more advanced preparation went into the remarkable title sequences devised by Joe McGrath. Lots of time spent on coming up with the ideas, lots of time spent sort of rehearsing in front of the audience and then quickly filming it with minimal sets. And again, a very different kind of approach to the whole process of doing the series and the creation of a new kind of surreal and definitely not satire comedy. Peter Cook especially was very adamant that this was not satire, that they would not talk about anything topical, and that this would help not only in sort of giving it a timelessness, but also rebroadcast it. Because again, we're so accustomed now to a very different kind of market that something, once it's been released, it's out there and it can be rewatched again and again and again. Imagine back to those days when television was something that happened once. Even if it wasn't live, it happened once. And if you didn't see it, too bad, it's gone. So the whole process of dealing with the music was pretty much left to Dudley. But the comedy was largely the two of them sitting down and creating these sketches together. And they would sit for hours just going on and on and just making things up as they went along. They would sort of tighten it down to what they thought they liked. They would have someone type it up. And again, Peter Cook was very adamant that their typist had to type it exactly as they said it, with all of the pauses and repetitions and everything that is in it exactly as they said it. You know, so they would just speak into the recorder and then have it typed up, and then they would learn it. And they would almost always not quite tell each other everything they were going to do. And this led to a lot of the spontaneity that you see in the performances. And also the inadvertent corpsing. Corpsing is a great thing. It's when you laugh when you're not supposed to. And again, sort of all the background of acting that has all of these kinds of very macabre sort of suggestions. Again, like the Scottish play, another, you know, one of these. But corpsing is when you inadvertently break into laughing when you're supposed to be doing, you know, you're supposed to be keeping your face as it is. The stars, should we say, as characters of, I was going to say Beyond the Fringe, not only but also, or the characters very clearly, closely related to who they are, Pete and Dud. But it's kind of interesting sort of how they developed from the sort of dumb and dumber, almost incels, really, sitting in a pub talking about their lives. And because their lives are so boring, they're made up lives, they're fantasy lives, really. And this all came together between the dialogues that they had planned in advance, holding back certain information so that the other would just end up corpsing because they hadn't expected it. And also that because of this minimalism of the sets and the costuming, that they end up being in sort of these, you know, overcoats and scarves and the cloth caps. And they became very iconic figures, so much that everybody was, you know, going around doing impressions of them. And it was really just the silliest stuff, the initial dialogue, the two of them sitting in the pub and talking about, you know, how things are and just, you know, the terrible predations upon their life. And what are those terrible predations? Well, you know, things like Adam Egnani in the kitchen and Dud having to tell her to get out. And of course, most famously, the Greta Garbo in her shorty nighty, sort of hanging onto the windowsill and beseechingly calling to Peter, Peter, you know, open the window and let me in. And it, you know, of course, had to knock her hands to knock her down to the ground to get her from off the windowsill. And this idea that in their minds they were completely beset by these film stars that, of course, you know, by the end of the sketch, they're like, well, so do you want to go to the cinema tomorrow night? But it's so funny and so very deadpan, except when, of course, they crack each other up. And I'll have to do something separately talking about the actual sketches themselves. Well, now I'm just kind of talking about the history behind it. But it took off in a huge way, a very huge way. There's a great story from Tony Visconti talking about in the studio, David Bowie and Brian Eno talking to each other like Pete and Dud. And I mean, everybody everywhere was doing this. It was very hugely exciting. There ended up being three series of Not Only But Also, including there was also a Christmas special, as often happens when people are really starting to get busy. And it's like, but can't we lure you back? Come and do a Christmas special. And so it became kind of their playground, too, where they could try out this more surreal kind of comedy. Peter Cook insisted, you know, they would never do just sort of straightforward, jokey ends, but that they would do unusual things and different things and try out different things. And they worked together in this very interesting way that continued to be a success for them. And the one place that Dudley was able to sort of draw back Pete was no singing. Not just because, you know, Dudley Moore was the professional musician, but also that it was quite clear to everyone, Peter Cook could not sing and he had no sense of rhythm. So the only singing he ended up doing pretty much was their farewell song, which was just goodbye, and even was released as a single, which, you know, if you've ever heard it, it's really not. It's just funny. They were going to write lyrics for it later and they just never did. So goodbye is pretty much the only lyrics. I mean, they do later do a few actual songs, including there's a really excellent, almost faux Beatlesque piece called the LS Bumblebee. And it's really quite good. But yeah, Peter Cook was always wanting to break into his Elvis impression and nobody wanted that. They really managed to stop him. If you want to read the dialogues, they were released as the Dagenham Dialogues by Methuen. I'm not sure when. I have a copy. So did I grab that off the shelf? No, I did not. But a lot of the ones that you can still see now are in there, and a bunch of others that are not. And why is that? Oh, because most of the shows were wiped. This is the BBC. This is what they did over and over again. They never thought about the future. There's no archivist, apparently, with any kind of voice anyway, at the BBC. This is the story of many shows. Many things were just completely wiped. We have some of the episodes because Joe McGrath broke the rules. And there was a very primitive videoing opportunity, which was pointing a television camera at the screen while it was playing and making a copy that way. So a lot of the crew on the shows loved it and wanted copies of the show. That's how they made some. And that's why we have some today. It's like another famous story. Much, much later, the dialogues between Chris Morris and Peter Cook, which were released as Why Bother? Chris Morris dumpster dived to get those tapes when he heard they were tossed out. But I mean, the BBC just had no thought for tomorrow, and they had no thought of any of this being of interest or of value. It was light entertainment, and it was gone. They did not care. And so this story overdosed. But there are a couple of videotapes that you can get. Videotapes, what am I saying? There are a couple of DVD releases of what's the best of what's left of Not Only But Also. And there are some illegal, of course, pirated versions as well that you can get and show up on places like YouTube. And I highly recommend them. And I think I will actually start with a duck and them dialogues maybe next time. Who knows? I don't, you know, I'm just making this up as I go along, depending upon what interests me this week, that I still seem to be able to keep up with this. I may not next week because I have to be away. So, see you next time, whenever that may be. Bye.